Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Lisa Gilbert of Public Citizen, who discusses President Trump's firing of U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions and the mobilization of people across the U.S. to protect Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia collusion investigation. Norman Solomon, co-founder of the online activist group RootsAction.org, who argues that the incoming Democratic Party majority in the House of Representatives should govern as progressives, and Jared Margolis of the Center for Biological Diversity, who talks about a federal judge's ruling that blocks construction of the Keystone XL pipeline as he ordered a supplemental environmental impact statement. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Amid international calls for a ceasefire, Saudi Arabia-led forces in Yemen have launched a new offensive in the port city of Hodeidah. Pro-government militias backed by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are attempting to push out Houthi rebels by the end of the year, when United Nations-backed peace talks begin. Since the Saudi coalition launched attacks in Yemen in 2015, the coalition imposed a blockade of Hodeidah, Yemen's main port city, which has led to famine and a deadly outbreak of cholera. A spokesperson for Save the Children maintains that the hunger crisis in Yemen shows no signs of fading as long as the fighting persists. In late October, U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis urged the Saudis to end their three-year proxy war in Yemen and join UN peace talks. In recent days, the Pentagon announced that it will halt all U.S. refueling of Saudi military aircraft in Yemen. UN human rights monitors have accused Saudi-led forces of committing multiple war crimes in Yemen. Humanitarian groups have also condemned Houthi rebels for occupying hospitals and putting civilian lives at risk of new Saudi airstrikes. Through the three-year war, an estimated 56,000 Yemenis have been killed and left 14 million people on the brink of starvation. In late October, the nation of Sri Lanka fell into a constitutional crisis when President Maithripala Sirisena fired Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe and replaced him with former authoritarian President Mahinda Rajapaksa, accused of human rights abuses and corruption. The deposed Prime Minister has refused to leave office and received support from members of parliament, triggering a major political crisis. Wickremesinghe is an advocate of closer ties with India and Japan, while President Sirisena has the backing of China. Amid the dueling prime ministers, President Sirisena dissolved parliament and called for new elections in early January. 3 years ago, President Sirisena and deposed Prime Minister Wickremesinghe were united in ousting Rajapaksa, who used brutal military tactics to defeat the Tamil Tiger rebels in a decades-long civil war. The new president and prime minister pledged to enact economic reforms, crack down on corruption, and initiate a war crimes investigation. Relations soured as Rajapaksa reclaimed the support of the nation's nationalist Buddhist majority. Tensions are rising as the country's Tamil and Muslim minorities fear that Rajapaksa will roll back freedoms and democratic gains made under Wickremesinghe in recent years. Seven major grocery chains employing over 125,000 workers have filed for bankruptcy over the last 3 years. The media has blamed disruptors, such as low-cost competitors like Walmart and Whole Foods, now owned by Amazon. But the American Prospect asserts that the real culprits in the industry are private equity owners who are behind all seven bankruptcies. In the process, investors extracted tens of millions of dollars from chains like A&P, Pathmark, Winn-Dixie, and Fairway. Supermarket workers, by far one of the most unionized retail sectors, has lost ground. Among the 1.3 million members of the United Food and Commercial Workers, 60% work in food chains, while 15% work in meatpacking and food processing. The leveraged buyout of Southeastern Grocers which owns Winn-Dixie and other food stores, is a classic example of how private equity's quest for quick profits drives retail chains out of business. Lone Star Funds bought the Buy Low chain in a 2005 buyout and took the company private. It ran the company into bankruptcy by 2009 and emerged from Chapter 11 in 2010. It then unsuccessfully tried to sell the chain. Between 2011 and 2013, it paid itself and its investors $839 million in dividends, money that could have been used to make stores more competitive. The multiple abuses by private equity firms exist only because of loopholes in the law. Public policies can reduce incentives for the type of financial engineering that drove these grocery chains into bankruptcy. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
After months of complaining about Attorney General Jeff Sessions' decision to recuse himself from overseeing Robert Mueller's investigation into allegations of Trump campaign collusion with the Russians, President Trump fired his one-time ally just 2 days after the midterm election, where the GOP lost control of the House of Representatives. Trump then bypassed the normal protocol for succession by appointing Sessions' Chief of Staff Matthew Whitaker as acting Attorney General, who will now oversee the Mueller probe. Legal observers in the state of Maryland have challenged the constitutionality of installing Whitaker as the nation's chief law enforcement officer without Senate confirmation, and point to his public criticism of the Mueller investigation, which included his advocacy of defunding the special counsel's budget and limiting the scope of the inquiry. In response to Sessions' firing, a broad coalition of groups launched 1,000 rallies nationwide on November 8th, calling for the Mueller investigation to be protected. For many months, these groups had been planning a rapid response to any threats that jeopardized the Mueller probe. Your reporter spoke with Lisa Gilbert, Vice President of Legislative Affairs with Public Citizen, who emceed the recent Nobody is Above the Law protest in Washington, D.C. Here she discusses Trump's firing of Attorney General Sessions, conflicts of interest, questionable ethics surrounding acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker, and threats to derail the Mueller investigation.
You know, we are very concerned that the removal of Sessions happened so quickly and the person that was put in is so unqualified, potentially unconstitutionally appointed, and clearly biased. You know, on that last point, he is the only potential candidate that Trump could have found who was within the DOJ, who was so clearly already out there with a blueprint for how to undermine the Mueller investigation. In some ways, he was interviewing for his job at the DOJ by writing about his plan to defund the investigation and to rein it in CNN or in the Wall Street Journal, speaking about it on television. So there's no question that Trump knew his pre-existing perspectives on the damage that the Mueller probe was doing to Trump and his family. That bias is very concerning, the fact that he shouldn't even been put in at all because the deputy AG is still there, and that's the line of succession. Rod Rosenstein should have become AG. So there are real constitutional questions. And then above all, the sort of ongoing just corruption allegations that we've seen about this man, you know, that is what makes him unqualified, the wrongdoing he's done in the past. So for all these reasons, you know, we triggered a rapid response network around the country because we thought that this was just unacceptable. So we were, you know, of course, concerned that we were asking activists to turn out right after an election season where so many of them had done so much and fought so hard for their preferred candidates and done GOTV for months. So we have a host of exhausted people, and we're going to ask them to turn out and organize rallies around the country. It was certainly a questionable prospect, but what we proved is that the American public really gets that it's not okay to violate the rule of law, and we were overwhelmed and thrilled at the outcome that we received. 1,000 rallies in every state, 100,000 people turning out. And people just showed that this is something that matters to them, and they're not going to take attacks on the Mueller investigation lying down.
Given the fact that Acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker has stated he's not going to recuse himself. What can the incoming Democratic-controlled House of Representatives do to protect the Mueller probe from Matt Whitaker if he follows through on his published and televised comments of his antipathy towards Mueller and his probe?
Sure. Well, there are a number of things that they can do. Some of them can be undertaken before the Democrats take control of the House, and some of them can only happen when the Dems have the tools of oversight that they will gain starting in January. But in the meantime, both chambers should immediately pass the legislation, the bipartisan legislation that would protect Bob Mueller. The bill that moved through the Senate Judiciary Committee earlier this year has been introduced in both chambers and simply says that Mueller cannot be fired without cause. So that's something that we just need to put in place to make sure that he is protected. Still further, we'd like to see additional legislation put in place, which would insulate Mueller, protect him if Whitaker stays in place or if there's another attorney general who also wants to undermine the probe. Mueller should be given independence and insulated and given the choice to release the report if he writes one in his own time. There's a real precedent for this in the Watergate situation when Archibald Cox was fired, and Leanne Jaworski was brought in. Robert Bork, who was the current AG at the time, issued an executive order to protect Leanne Jaworski, to insulate him and say that he had complete independence and Mueller could be given those same protections. So those are two things we'd like to see happen legislatively or through executive order, which can happen anytime. Obviously, we'll have a better chance come January. And then in addition, in January, we'd like to see strong oversight. If Whitaker's still there, he needs to be the first witness that Nadler calls in the Judiciary Committee in the House.
Now, just to drill down a bit on what you talked about, there have been scenarios that if Matt Whitaker or some other Trump ally is head of the Department of Justice, there could be an effort to suppress any final report that comes out of the Mueller investigation. If that happens, there are many legal scholars out there who talk about a constitutional crisis. If the DOJ and the Trump White House basically say, we're going to lock away this Mueller report and no one will ever see it, that will certainly abrogate what I think majority of the nation feels should be done in terms of a full, fair, and open investigation of what the president and his campaign did or did not do in terms of collusion with the Russians during the 2016 election.
So that's completely right. And there's a reason that our fourth red line for our citizen activists is that exact thing. If the Mueller report is suppressed, if there isn't transparency in the findings, one thing is for sure, the public is very deserving of a final explanation of what happened. We've all watched the circus of the last 2 years and seen endless denials, claims of no collusion from the president. We deserve to know what Mueller has found. And we've seen the pretty impressive track record from what is public, the litany of indictments and charges. And so we need to know the rest, and I think are entitled to see it. If we don't, I imagine there will be massive outrage, and certainly the House will use all of the tools that they have to call for answers.
That was Lisa Gilbert, Vice President of Legislative Affairs with Public Citizen. For more analysis and commentary on Trump's firing of Jeff Sessions and threats against the Mueller probe, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The expected blue wave of Democratic Party victories on election night didn't materialize quite the way it was predicted during the early vote count in the eastern half of the U.S. But a week later, as results of close races trickled in, the party has gained 32 seats in the House thus far and appears headed to gain between 35 and 40 seats once all the votes are counted and validated. Initially, Democrats appear to be losing some key Senate races, but a week later, after Kristen Sinema was declared the winner in Arizona, Democrats will likely lose one or two seats rather than the three or four originally forecast. Lower down on the ballot, Democrats flipped 7 governorships, 6 state legislative chambers, and more than 300 state House and Senate seats on election night. With vote counts still underway in key races in Florida and Georgia, and several in California, Democrats won a larger landslide in 2018 than Republicans did in either 1994 or 2010. The diversity of Democratic candidates, with a record-breaking number of victories by women and people of color in 2018, is historic in and of itself. Your reporter spoke with Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org and founding director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Here he talks about his recent article titled, A Challenge to the New Blue Congress Govern as Progressives, where he argues that the incoming Democratic House majority should strongly advocate for popular progressive policy initiatives such as Medicare for All, a $15 minimum wage, and higher taxes on the nation's wealthiest citizens.
In a significant extent, the Democrats were able to flip seats, I think, in spite of the National Party, not because of it. There are a lot of independent progressive groups that did a tremendous amount of outreach targeted to specific congressional districts with some really good results. And even when there were some high-profile, strong progressive candidates that did not win, such as Beto O'Rourke running for Senate in Texas, such as, and we don't have the final results in, but probably Andrew Gillum, the gubernatorial candidate in Florida, has not won. We don't know that for sure. But those candidates in Texas, in Florida, also Stacey Abrams in Georgia, who may not have won that gubernatorial race, but also inspired many people at the grassroots to turn out, and that really is the key word. Turnout was greatly enhanced by these dynamic progressive candidates like O'Rourke, like Gillum, like Abrams. And that meant that people were also voting on down ballot positions that meant Republicans lost some very close races. So the dynamism is really coming from progressives across the board in this country. That's why people turn out. Who in particular am I referring to? I'm talking about young people who overwhelmingly vote against Republicans for Democrats when they vote, and people of color likewise when they vote. It's not enough to say we're going to vote against Republicans, as bad as they are, and they're surely atrocious, but to draw out people who are young, people of color who may feel understandably alienated from the political process, it's essential to give them somebody to vote for who's going to be on the ballot.
Recent polling has shown that the American people, by and large, support higher taxes on the wealthy, support Medicare for All, support a $15 minimum wage, with the House of Representatives now with a Democratic majority. What is their obligation to follow up on that agenda, given the fact that with a Republican-controlled Senate and the White House still under Donald Trump, pushing legislation forward is not really a viable option. But what kind of groundwork can be laid for a progressive agenda in these and many other areas over the next couple of years while the Democrats do maintain a majority in the House?
Well, I think groundwork is a good word, that a lot won't get accomplished until after the 2020 election. But it is possible to block some bad legislation because Democrats control the House starting in January, and also because of the sort of push-pull, to some extent, to be able to get some legislation passed and signed into law, that's good. We should remember, for instance, that there's a large caucus in the House of Representatives called the Progressive Caucus. It now has around 80 members. And because the Republicans have lost the House, next year, there are going to be 12 members of the Progressive Caucus who chair committees of the House and 30 others who control, by being chair, subcommittees of the House. That potentially is very powerful in terms of economic and social justice issues. And we found time and again, and unfortunately this was the case often during 8 years of the Obama administration, that grassroots progressives too often just defer to Democrats who are in Congress. Don't give them a push when they're dragging their feet. Don't confront them when they come home during town hall meetings and so forth. Really, the opposite needs to happen. Whether it's those dozen and 30 chairs of committees and subcommittees I mentioned in the House coming up, or whether it's any of the more than 200 Democrats in the House of Representatives come next year, we've got to be willing to confront and push them. Because you can bet your bottom dollar that Wall Street and the corporate lobbyists, they're already pushing those Democrats, as are corporate news media outlets and editorial writers and pundits. Don't go too fast. Don't move to the left. defer to the center, whatever that might mean, which is basically the status quo that so many people reject. And that is a challenge ahead. Really, history is going to be made by people at the grassroots, depending on what we do and what we don't do.
That was Norman Solomon, co-founder and coordinator of the online activist group, RootsAction.org. Find a link to Solomon's recent article titled, A Challenge to the New Blue Congress, Govern as Progressives, and related material by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A federal judge ruled on November 8th that the Trump administration violated several key environmental laws when it approved, as one of its first actions after taking office, TransCanada's proposed Keystone XL tar sands pipeline project. The judge blocked any construction on the pipeline and ordered the government to conduct a supplemental environmental impact statement, or EIS. This ruling follows the court's previous decision on August 15th to require additional analysis of the pipeline's new route through Nebraska, approved last year by the Nebraska Public Service Commission. The project, which would send 830,000 barrels a day of tar sands oil, the most polluting form of fossil fuel, across the U.S.-Canadian border, requires approval from the U.S. State Department. If built, the Keystone XL pipeline would cross Montana, South Dakota, and Nebraska before meeting up with TransCanada's existing pipeline system in the U.S. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Jared Margolis, a senior attorney with the Center for Biological Diversity, one of the six plaintiff organizations that filed a lawsuit against the pipeline in March 2017. The center first intervened in the case because the pipeline is located on the flyway of endangered whooping cranes. Here Margolis explains what the ruling from U.S. District Court Judge Brian Morris could mean for the future of the pipeline project.
What the court found was that the government didn't do a full analysis of the impacts that Keystone XL would have on the environment. And what we have is the National Environmental Policy Act requires agencies to undertake what they call a hard look at the consequences of the agencies approving a project like this. And here the State Department didn't take that hard look at issues regarding the greenhouse gas emissions associated with the project, the impacts of oil spills, and some other issues like that. And they also didn't account for the fact that the government determined under the Obama administration that this project was not in the national interest. And yet here the Trump administration reversed course and said that it was within the national interest without fully explaining that reversal in their decision. And that sends a really important message to the Trump administration, which says you can't just make these decisions without some support, without some acknowledgement of the impacts of those decisions.
So the ruling was that the State Department needs to do another environmental impact statement or add to the existing one?
So here they need to do what they call a supplemental environmental impact statement. That's a whole new document that supplements the existing environmental impact statement. That supplemental document is subject to the same public comment period and the same oversight that the initial environmental impact statement is subject to. So we'll have a whole full process here that looks at the supplemental issues that the court said need to be fully addressed.
Jared Margolis, I read that it's possible that rather than go down that road, the Trump administration might appeal this ruling.
Certainly, they could decide to appeal the ruling and take this to the Ninth Circuit. There's a couple of arguments they could make. The big one would be the government has taken the position here that the National Environmental Policy Act actually doesn't apply in this situation. Their argument is that this is a presidential decision. The permit that is being issued here is something that was created by an executive order, and their argument is that that therefore gives the president the authority, and the president isn't subject to the National Environmental Policy Act. The problem with that argument is that the decision is actually being made by the State Department here. And the State Department, as an agency of the government, is subject to the National Environmental Policy Act. And we went through this issue on what they call motions to dismiss early in this case, and the judge sided with us and agreed that as an agency, the State Department does have to follow the National Environmental Policy Act, and then, as you know, subsequently determine that they did not fully comply with that law. The government will then likely argue on appeal that the president's decision here, even though it was made by the State Department, isn't subject to NEPA, and we'll have to deal with that at the appellate level. But we don't know what they're going to appeal. We don't know if there's other aspects of the case they will appeal. We believe that we are correct on that point. We believe that the judge was correct in ruling in our favor on that point, and we think the Ninth Circuit will agree that the State Department should be making this decision with a full understanding of the risks involved, which requires an environmental impact statement under NEPA.
Either way, whether they go with a supplemental environmental impact statement, or EIS, or decide to appeal the judge's decision, what kind of delay do you think we're looking at?
It's difficult to say in terms of time frame. If they do a decent job, if they were actually going to address all of the issues that the judge is saying they need to address in a reasonable way, it will take likely up to a year or more to do that. If they appeal, it depends on the posture of the case. It depends on if they ask for review at the Ninth Circuit in a more expedited review, as they call it. We don't know if that'll occur. But yes, this is likely to delay any construction activities for at least 6 months to a year if we're going to be looking at this in a reasonable manner.
TransCanada says they're sticking with this project, which was first proposed 10 years ago and has run into fierce opposition from Indigenous groups, climate activists, and local residents in the path of the pipeline. Do you think it will get built?
You know, while they haven't made a decision yet, it seems, this is definitely going to make it harder for this project to ever get built. And we think we're confident that this is going to, hopefully result in this project being abandoned, because it's in everyone's real interest, except for the few people who are going to make money off of that project. It's in everyone's interest not to be tapping into these horrible tar sands. And it's an important point to remember that there are not very many jobs from this project. This is not benefiting America. This is Canadian product that's likely going to Asia. This is not in our interests, and to allow the construction of this devastating project across our country is simply, it's unconscionable.
That was Jared Margolis, a senior attorney with the Center for Biological Diversity. Learn more about continuing opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline project by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Caree Brittum's radio in Tucker, Georgia, WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.